Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for accompanying me on this voyage, the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And I'm pleased to welcome back to the show, film scholar and professor emeritus from Indiana University, James Naremore. Welcome back.
Oh, hey. Thanks. Glad to be back. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for agreeing to reprise your role as distinguished guest. On today's show, we're going to discuss the 41st movie on the Sight and Sound list, Roberto Rossellini's 1954 film, Journey to Italy. I know Journey to Italy is probably best known as one of Rossellini's infamous collaborations with his then-wife, movie star Ingrid Bergman. But for me, the movie stands out as one of the great leading roles for my all-time favorite actor, George Sanders. Sanders is more often considered a character actor who fulfills a very specific niche. Need a sarcastic, haughty British man for your picture? Give George a ring. But despite the frequent pigeonholing, Mr. Sanders was always an indelible screen presence. So for today's topic, we're going to talk about how some performers become known as character actors and what exactly distinguishes them from leading men or women. Finally, we're going to finish things up with a brief update from Professor Naremore on his slate of projects for 2016. All right, Professor, are you ready to start digging?
I suppose so.
Let's do it then. Yeah. First up, we have Roberto Rossellini's 1954 tale of domestic turmoil, Journey to Italy. There's something about Roberto Rossellini that's just really fun to say. The film follows as unhappily married British couple Alexander and Catherine Joyce venture to Naples, Italy, to sell a recently inherited villa. During their travels, and even after they get to their destination, Catherine and Alex squabble about all manner of petty grievances. Everything from ex-lovers to spaghetti dinner is a source of contention. Eventually, the simmering resentment becomes too much for Alex to bear, and he heads off to Capri, an island just off the coast, leaving Catherine alone to explore the local Neapolitan museums and geological sites. Despite their obvious marital troubles, both of them find that they aren't all that happy being off by themselves. The remainder of the film sees Alex and Catherine mulling over their options. Should they divorce, or should they honor their marriage vows? And perhaps more significantly, will either option bring them happiness? Journey to Italy was a turning point in Rossellini's career. His early works, with their unflinching verite style and focus on the downtrodden, basically served as the template for all of the Italian neorealist movement. But today's entry is his first film where the distress and hardship turn distinctly from economic to spiritual. This focus on existential misery would eventually become de rigueur for 1960s European cinema. Listeners will recall that we discussed Fellini's similar career trajectory in our La Dolce Vita episode. But unlike Fellini, Italian critics didn't embrace Rossellini's transition. It could be because Journey to Italy precedes La Dolce Vita by about 6 years, and critics weren't yet ready to start tackling problems of the heart instead of the pocketbook. But today, critics seem to have completely come around on this film, naming it the 41st movie on the Sight and Sound list. But is it worthy of the resurgence? We shall discuss. Okay, so Jim, when did you first see Journey to Italy, and what was your initial reaction?
Well, you know, I honestly don't remember the first time I saw it, and I think I saw it pretty late. That is, I think I was, you know, already teaching film studies in a university before I first saw it. I had heard of it, but I think that's when I first saw it, somewhere around in there. And I suspect also that the first version of it that I saw was a sort of truncated, edited version of the film that was distributed, you know, in Europe and in the U.S. On its initial release, because the distributors didn't like Rossellini's pacing, the long longueurs in the middle of the film. Mm-hmm. So they cut some small episodes of it out. So today it has a wonderful print of it in circulation from Criterion that you can see the full length of the film. But I don't think I saw it then. Okay. And what struck me about the film, and it maybe it was just me because I have an intense interest in James Joyce, is that there are lots of references to James Joyce in it, and I noticed that, and it didn't seem as though very many people had noticed that. The leading characters, played by Sanders and Ingrid Bergman, are Mr. and Mrs. Joyce, and they are on a journey to Italy to settle the estate of their uncle Homer.
Right.
And then when they get there, there's a scene in the film where the married couple sit down and I can read you a little bit of the dialogue. You mind if I do that?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
She says she's talking about a young man she had an unconsummated love affair with. He was a young poet. And she says he read his poetry to me. He even copied some Temple of the Spirit, no longer body but pure ascetic images, compared to which mere thought seems flesh, heavy, dim. He wrote them in Italy during the war.
Hmm.
And he says, I never knew you were such great friends. She says, I knew him before I met you. And he says, were you in love with him? She says, no, but we got on very well together. I saw a great deal of him. And then he got desperately ill. I couldn't even visit him. For almost a year, I didn't see him until the eve of our wedding, the night before I left for London. I was packing my bags when I heard the sound of pebbles on my window. The rain was so heavy I couldn't see anyone outside, so I ran out into the garden just as I was, and there he stood. He was shivering with cold. He was so strange and romantic. Maybe he wanted to prove to me that in spite of the high fever, he had braved the rain to see me, or maybe he wanted to die. And he says, he says in a very George Sanders way, how very poetic, much more poetic than his verses. that's a scene that's almost directly out of James Joyce's short story, The Dead. Mm. Have you ever read The Dead?
I have not, but I read I read something that where you mentioned the comparison. Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's a dialogue almost exactly like that in The Dead. The Dead is about a marriage and also about a society. Kind of a moribund society, and the central character, the husband, in The Dead, is a man who's intelligent in some ways, talented, but has compromised his life. He's cautious. He stays in Dublin in a kind of a bourgeois a marriage. His wife is more interesting than he is. She's not as well educated. She comes from the west of Ireland. She's beautiful, but I think he kind of looks down on her in certain ways. And the story, they just go to a party, and when they come back that evening, he's kind of tumescent, ready to jump into bed with her. And she tells him this story about this fellow named Michael Fury, who was a poet, who stood outside her room and tapped on the windshield with pebbles and died mm-hmm. as a result. And the effect is different. What this does to the husband is disturb him greatly. I mean, he goes from tumescence to detumescence, and he realizes that this was a passionate love affair, and he's lived a kind of passionless life. That's not the way it works in the Rossellini film. Nevertheless, I think the Rossellini film is about many of the same things as. Joyce's story, The Dead, is to say that the Rossellini film is about a troubled marriage. And Laura Mulvey has made this point about the film, that it's about the way the dead can't really be separated from the living, that ghosts of the past are still present in some way.
Right.
And this is in a less obvious way in the Joyce story. It's also in the Rossellini film, it's about the way the way history is, and this is especially true in Naples, the way history still is present. The past is still present in some way.
Right.
The sort of the inability to move to separate those things. They overlap, or they're continuous with one another. So the film is very much about death. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are images of death everywhere in Naples. Anyway, that really struck me about the film. And I didn't know what else to make of the film, though. One of the things that's unusual about the film and that really grows on you The more you watch it, is that, and I think it, most people, when they first saw it, didn't see this, but it's almost as if nothing happens in the film. A great deal happens in the film, but Rossellini doesn't treat it the way movie makers usually do. He's been described, he described himself as impassive in his approach to the films, or and other people have called him reticent. But it's as though he treats trivial events in the same way, gives as much attention to them as he does key dramatic events. So I could imagine that the initial audience for the film felt like nothing much was happening in this film.
Right, right. And yet, you know, 59, La Ventura came out, and it's very similar.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would say, though, that both Fellini and Antonioni are visually more striking than Rossellini is. It's not that Rossellini doesn't create good images, but he is a he's a less showy director.
Yeah.
And so the I don't know if it's right to call it the plainness of his style, but his refusal to be cinematically showy,
right,
makes him seem a little different from those filmmakers.
I could buy that. And John Huston made an adaptation of The
right.
Dead, right?
Right. Right.
Are there any similarities between the two films?
Well, I've written about this, but I think that it's interesting. I don't think that Rossellini was necessarily interested in The Dead that much. And I think probably the references to Joyce may have come from his screenwriter or his co-screenwriter, Vitoliano Brancati. I think I'm pronouncing the name correctly. And I think they were originally going to make a film based on a Colette story.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, the Huston film is a straight adaptation. That is to say, it tries to be quite faithful to the Joyce story, whereas Rossellini's screenwriter are only kind of alluding to it, borrowing from it, sort of in the way Joyce borrows from Homer or Shakespeare or mm-hmm. whatever when he's working. So Rossellini is a more modernist film maker than Huston is,
mm-hmm.
In that sense.
Yeah,
it's a kind of sly elusiveness that an appropriation in a certain way rather than an adaptation.
Right. You mentioned the film is largely about death and the way that the dead are always with us. But how does that play into the love story here?
I don't think it plays in as directly as it does in the Joyce story. I didn't mean to say that, but I think the way it figures in the film has to do an awful lot with the setting. I think Rossellini was as interested in Naples as he was in his characters, and he through Catherine's exploration of Naples, she keeps encountering the past, often the deep past, and the dead. She goes to an archaeological museum. She goes to we see her going to Vesuvius to the cave of the Sibyl at Cumae, the lava fields near Vesuvius.
Yeah, did she? She
the Fontanelle catacombs.
Yeah, the catacombs. Yeah,
and they're just full of skulls and dead.
Right.
And then of course what's happening is the marriage is kind of tense and falling apart. And just at the moment when Sandra says, "Okay, let's have a divorce," this guide comes up to them and says, "Hey, look, something really special is going to happen over at Pompeii. They found some things," and they don't want to go. But he drags them off there, and so they together go into one of these excursions. And we see the archaeologist or whatever unearthing some new figures under the dust, the lava, or whatever. And it's a man and a wife, apparently,
right,
or a male and a female caught in a sort of death embrace.
Right.
And this is some kind of turning point in the film. That theme of death somehow charges into their relationship and their marriage. And it's an interesting debate about whether the film has a happy ending or not. But eventually they do decide not to break apart.
Right.
And they do this in
the
middle. Right, not at that moment necessarily, but they go What is it? There's a religious parade, and they get caught up in a crowd there. It's a parade that Catholic ritual where miracles happen, and you see, you know, a man who's supposedly crippled carrying his crutches over his head. He's been cured and so forth. As the statue of the Virgin Mary is carried through a crowd, they get separated, and she gets panicky, and he tries to find her. And finally, when they get together in the middle of this crowd, they decide they're going to stay together.
Right.
It's you could say that it's a Hollywood happy ending, but I don't know. I can't tell about this couple.
Yeah, it feels so hollow.
Uh huh.
We've watched them bicker for an hour and 20 minutes, and suddenly in the last 5 minutes, it's a miracle. They're back together.
Right.
It's almost. Do you think it was meant to be ironic?
I think he means, I don't know. I think he means that they are reconciled in this moment.
Hmm.
But I just don't know how long that reconciliation is going to last. One of the things, a couple of things are going on here. Maybe if your listeners haven't seen the film, they play a Northern European couple. Ingrid Bergman keeps her, what would you call her, Swedish accent.
Right.
And of course, George Sanders, as you say, specialized in this kind of cynical British, more British than the British kind of behavior. And he's distant and cynical, and I find myself sympathizing with her because he seems so discontented all the time.
Yeah.
But what's happened is that they are plunged into a world that that's just utterly different from their own culture. This is southern Italy. It's full of bugs and cows and crowds of people and
olive oil.
Olive oil, yeah. And I think this exacerbates the tension between these two. And I think it's significant that they're childless, because when she goes driving alone through the city, she keeps observing pregnant women or women with baby carriages everywhere. He's a businessman, and I don't know. I can't remember exactly what she is, but they have that kind of companionate life where when they get off alone in Italy, they can't connect with each other very well.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah. I wanted to talk more about the fossils that they unearth at Pompeii.
Right.
Obviously, we talked about ghosts and images of the dead, and the looming specter in this movie, I think, is probably World War II. And they've been through crises, but in the past, in the very near past, what I would suspect is they probably banded together during those times of crisis.
Yeah,
and now
it could be.
That
mm-hmm.
now that that's over, all that's left is they've mm-hmm. survived, but there's still this lingering sense of death.
Yeah,
and that neither of them can address.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that probably speaks to Rossellini's state of mind at the time, because prior to this film, he was mostly known as this neorealist filmmaker who made films about either post-war Italy or, in the case of Paisan, war.
Wartime Italy. Yeah,
yeah. Wartime mm-hmm. Italy. Mm-hmm. So... it seems like a kind of cynical view of romance, or it's like we cling to these idealistic notions of love and romance during times of crises, like, for instance, when a volcano is erupting,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When that's over, there's nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. I never thought about the shadow of the war being over the film, but I think that's quite right. Yeah.
Mm.
The marriage is also these are wealthy people, and they you get the sense that when they are in when they're visiting Italy and visiting Naples, they live in a kind of cocoon. They have a they have servants, but they don't interact with them very well and can't understand them. They have a sort of guide who shows them around, and they have interaction with a sort of decadent early jet set, I guess you'd call them. You see them in a scene at one point. And as you say, he goes off to Capri with some people. But they don't... it's rubbing up against sort of ordinary Neapolitan.
Right.
It exacerbates whatever tensions they have in their marriage.
Yeah, the Italian critics who were skeptical about Rossellini's new thematic territory. I mean, it's not so different.
No, but I guess we're sort of dancing around. The other big issue here is Ingrid Bergman.
Right.
I don't know if people realize this, but of course, Ingrid Bergman's marriage to Mo Rossellini, or at least her love affair with Rossellini, was one of the top Hollywood scandals of all time. I mean, it's right up there with the Fatty Arbuckle and all that stuff.
Yeah.
She left her husband and had a love affair and got pregnant by Rossellini out of wedlock, and Hollywood just went nuts about it.
Yeah.
And it probably affected his career as an international director more than it did her. But for a while, it looked like her career was destroyed by this. Mm-hmm. And yet, she was the one who initiated the contact with him. And it was on the heels of her greatest Hollywood flop, a movie about Joan of Arc, which lost all kinds of money. So I guess she was looking for a change in her career. George Sanders had just won the Academy Award for All About Eve as a supporting actor. But his career was kind of in limbo as well. So you have these two actors who are alien to the world with their acting. And it's almost like the film is to some extent about them as well. But anyway, Rossellini made three movies, or he made five movies with her, but there are three of them that are regarded as a kind of trilogy, and they all take place in Italy, different parts of Italy, and they all, I think, have just certain things in common. In all three films, Ingrid Bergman is a woman who is out of place, or she's the environment. She's well-to-do and more. From a different world than these strange Italian settings that she finds herself in. And the other thing that the three films have in common, I think, and I don't quite know what to make of this, but they have very strong religious motifs, all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Rossellini, I guess, was regarded as a sort of Marxist in his neorealist phase. But these films seem to have a lot of religious motifs going through them, and that religious processional at the end of the journey to Italy is, I think he's taking that seriously in some way.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. Most of his films are kind of agnostic, or at least they seem to me to be. But with Journey to Italy, and then Europa.
51, right.
Yeah, that is basically a religious parable.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Stromboli is less strong about this, but it is about a peasant village, and there are overtones of religious symbolism in that film, too.
Right, and a priest is a very prominent character.
Yeah, right.
That makes sense, because there was this transition in his career from, as you say, the Marxist neorealism to some more existential drama, which again follows a similar trajectory as many neorealist filmmakers. Again, grappling with what's happened. I mean, Italy was in such a different place in mid 1950s than it was in late 1940s. Just with the implementation of the Marshall Plan, it might seem kind of disingenuous to continue talking about it's exclusively about the lives of
maybe,
the poor. I don't know.
Maybe I don't know enough about Rossellini's biography to know what kind of how he fits into the historical events that are happening at that moment. But I do think that these films are very much about his relation to Ingrid Bergman too.
Mm-hmm. So, we should probably talk about the ways that life imitated art, or art imitated life. I don't know which came first. I imagine they were probably having troubles pr- prior to the making of this movie.
Yeah, I think it was such an international sensation, this, and so much a part of about tabloid literature at the time, that the audiences for these films, it would have been almost impossible for an audience to see this film without saying, hey, that's Ingrid Bergman and Rossellini's directing this. And, you know, just be very super conscious of the scandal that their relationship had caused. So,
right, right. Yeah. Another actually kind of disturbing way that this film ended up mirroring what events to come was Alex, George Sanders' character, talks about how bored he is all the time.
Yes,
and then in his suicide, George Sanders ended up committing suicide. And in his note, he wrote, I'm leaving because I'm bored.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which, if that's your legacy, like, that's both amazing and so sad.
Or in a way, it's the ultimate George Sandersism.
It is.
I mean, apparently he wasn't at all happy with the making of this movie, because he was unused to a director who worked the way Rossellini did. And in his autobiography, he seems respectful of Rossellini, but very grudging and thinking, you know, this movie was it was unpleasant to work with. I couldn't figure out what he wanted me to do, and blah blah blah. Anyway, he was a classically trained Hollywood actor, and he just didn't know how to work with Rossellini.
Right.
And I think most people seem to think that Rossellini didn't mind him being upset, because it sort of added to Alex Joyce's discomfort and the sense of his general dissatisfaction with things.
Right, right. Yeah, his attitude mirrors the character.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the frustration really comes across on screen. I believe Alex is deeply irritated.
Yeah, yeah.
The dynamic between in their relationship is fascinating and actually really frustrating to watch, because Alex is so frustrating.
Yeah. It never becomes violent. They remain civilized people, but they are it's almost like a fingernail scratching on a chalkboard or something like that sometimes in their interaction, and you just feel they can't ever connect with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love kind of comedy of discomfort.
Yeah, yeah. No, this isn't like that.
But yeah, this is sort of that flipped on its head. They're like, there's so much tension, and it seems like they just need to communicate better, and it could all be made better.
Yeah,
so it's like, it's just really frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. I think the movie had a big influence on Richard Linklater's Before Sunset,
right? Before Midnight, I thought.
Before Midnight, sorry. Yeah,
yeah.
In fact, I think there's some dialogue in that movie that it's clear he's making a reference to this film. I think Ethan Hawke talks about some movie he had seen, and it's this movie.
Oh,
anyway.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That movie starts off with the pair of them in a car bickering.
Right, right.
And then they don't actually separate ever, but they do wander around.
That's right.
Ancient ruins.
And they're in Greece, right?
Yeah, they're in Greece,
yeah.
So, there are a lot of parallels. Did you see By the Sea by any chance?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Does it echo? That'd be interesting. It's a situation similar to this, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people have been making that comparison. I mean, they've been drawing comparisons to this film as well as Antonioni, partially because, in case listeners are wondering, By the Sea is the 2015 Angelina Jolie movie starring her and Brad Pitt. Again,
and
people
are deeply,
celebrity couple, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and people are deeply divided about it, just as they were about Journey to Italy.
Right, exactly. And I wonder if in 50 years, By the Sea will also be hailed as a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We shall. Only time will tell.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this one, as you mentioned, this is part of an unofficial trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
But does this one stand out to you above the others?
I think it does. This is my favorite of the three. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also, I think this film had a stronger influence on other filmmakers than the other two did. Godard made a famous remark that after seeing this film, he said, it's like a home movie. He said, I don't know if I'll make a film, but I knew I could make a film after I saw this.
Yeah.
And the French New Wave as a whole were pretty nuts about this film. And it doesn't feel quite so much like a New Wave film to me, but it is, I think, more in common with them than with the Antonioni, which was the connection that's usually made.
Right.
And I think that's because it has a kind of combination of realism, meaning a documentary quality about Naples, which figures very large in the film, and a kind of, I don't know, self-reflexive, as you say, existentialist story about the marriage. Anyway, yeah.
You talk about the sort of maybe lack of visual style of Rossellini,
right,
maybe the lack of concern, but he does have this documentary style and similar. I don't know about Chart. Like, people have said similar things about Richard Linklater, so perhaps yet another parallel between the two films.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I know you don't mean it to be disparaging or anything, but it. I mean, I guess cinema. It depends on what you think cinema is for, and what it should do. Some people think like it's a visual medium, and therefore most of the emphasis should be on the visuals, which is a fair thing to say. But in, I think, this film and in Before Midnight, the aim is to highlight the emotions of the situation.
Right. I think Linklater's film has much more language in it, I think, than Rossellini does. But the two characters are, they have a history that they bring to the film because they've been the two previous films about them.
Right.
So it's not exactly the same kind of thing. And it's almost with the Rossellini film, Liz, you feel like there's been a previous story here, but you don't know exactly what it was. It's almost as though the movie begins with this couple riding down the road and you're in the middle of something in some way.
I mean, do you think that's because Rossellini knew that people would be, the audiences would be taking their own assumptions
well,
I, into the
I,
movie?
I think they probably were aware of that. Yeah. But I also think that his film, and many people have said this, that his film is as much about the geography around Naples as it is about this couple and the way it interacts with them. So it's not that the story is tangential, but it doesn't assume importance necessarily over these other things.
Mm.
And going back to the visual issue. I didn't mean to suggest that there isn't a visual beauty to Rossellini's work. It's just not the kind that audiences would immediately appreciate necessarily. It's more subtle,
right?
And there's some extraordinary moments in it. I think one of the most impressive parts of the film is the visit to the archaeological museum where he photographs statues in the museum. That is a really striking moment in the film, and the statues seem to stare back at us, and there are statues caught in figures in motion. So there's a self-reflexivity there. It's like photography, right? I mean, it's even with the couple around Vesuvius or Pompeii, rather. It's a moment of time that's been captured, and it's the way of the dead stay preserved in some way. I don't know.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. And then there was that great crane shot of I forget what the really large statue. I forget the name of it, but
it totally dwarfs
Bergman in the shot.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, there's some beautiful camera movements, and the thing is very interestingly lit. So he knows what he's doing with the camera. It's just that he's not. If you compare him to somebody like Fellini, you always feel with Fellini, you know, gosh, this is such a visual spectacle we're seeing.
Yeah.
But
you
don't get that with Rossellini.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I don't know. I think the blending of the Naples, the sort of the scenery around Naples with this couple, I think it's pretty seamless and really, it's really fascinating.
Yeah. I think it seems to me, too, that he doesn't go for the picturesque. I mean, he shows us a lot around Naples. He makes you curious about the place.
Yeah.
But he's not making postcard views of anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. They talk about the beautiful vistas.
Yeah.
But we don't really get any shots of them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some nice panning moves. He gives you a sense of the geography.
Right.
And you can see Vesuvius way in the background over a lot of interesting shots. Obviously, it's a sort of symbolic presence for the movie.
Right, right. But yeah, you're right. It's not, this is not sponsored by the Naples Tourism Bureau.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, final question on this topic. It is the 41st movie on the Sight and Sound list. Do you think it is worthy of the 41st spot?
I think my answer would be the same as no matter what film we were talking about. I mean, of course it's worthy. It may be worthy of the higher place. You could argue that this film has had as strong an influence on the cinema afterward as almost any we could name.
Yeah.
It really did inspire the French New Wave. And Laura Mulvey, who is tremendously fond of and has a very nice commentary on the Criterion edition of the film, she says it's one of her, it may be her favorite movie, you know. So there are... And Robin Wood was nuts about this movie. There are many, many people who've distinguished critical chops who really admire this film. So it could have gotten a higher ranking. I think it doesn't because a lot of people haven't seen it, and maybe also because it isn't the kind of movie that has influenced Hollywood very much.
Mm. Although maybe it has, as we've discussed.
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah. But those are kind of unusual films that influenced me.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that this movie, it may seem unassuming, and maybe it isn't as widely seen, but I think the influence is pretty far-reaching.
Yeah.
So if listeners haven't seen it, perhaps maybe go out and see it.
Yeah.
Our second topic, "Hey, it's that guy," is a common refrain uttered after spotting a familiar face in a movie or television show. It's often followed by, "Ooh, where do I know him from?" or "Where have I seen her before?" On rare occasion, those familiar faces sometimes steal the show right out from under the leads. When this happens, the "that guy" is afforded a title upgrade. They become known as character actors. As I mentioned in the intro, George Sanders, the co-star of Journey to Italy, is one of my all-time favorite character actors. And so, in his honor, we're going to discuss what exactly makes for a great character actor, and we're going to put a name to the faces and finally give some of our favorite "that guys" their due. So, Jim, how do you define character actor?
Well, I'm not sure, but let me talk about it for a second. I think, you know, the term is quite old. In Shakespeare's day, a character actor was the kind of actor who played certain character types in plays. In other words, if there was a clown, a fool, or if there was a king, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So the certain actors specialized in character types. I think in Hollywood the same thing persisted. The great age of, maybe it's just because of my age, but the great age of Hollywood character acting is the classic studio era. In that days, there were a lot of actors under contract, and they would be almost like a stock company, like a theatrical stock company, so that they could be used as colors to be dropped into films at any individual moment. Basically, the character actor definition that works best is just somebody who plays a supporting role. But when we say character actor, what I think people are talking about is an actor with a high degree of eccentricity. That is, the character actor is not handsome or sexy necessarily.
Right.
The character actor is interesting for just their eccentricity.
Yeah.
There's an old joke. You may have heard it. You know the character actor Jack Elam? You probably know the Aldrich Mickey Spillane adaptation. with Ralph Meeker.
Like Kiss Me Deadly?
Yeah, Kiss Me Deadly. Yeah. Elam is in that. So you've probably seen him from that. He's skinny and tall and ugly looking and wall-eyed. He has an eye that's out of place. And he was in he's a character actor in a lot of Westerns in the 50s and in the 40s, all the way up and through the 60s. And there used to be a joke the progress of his career would be some casting guy saying, "Who's Jack Elam?" And then a little time goes by and he says, "Oh, get me Jack Elam."
Mm-hmm.
And then the more time goes by and says, "Get me a Jack Elam type."
Right.
And then a little more time goes by and he says, "Who's Jack Elam?" Anyway, but Elam had that kind of career. You know, he was just, the directors got very fond of sticking him into movies because he had this unusual face and activity. To me, the great character actors were a little less outlandish than that. I think one of the greatest character actors of all time was Claude Rains.
Yeah.
And in fact, Billy Wilder said that when Claude Rains died, Hollywood died. He meant the kind of Hollywood that the old studio system represented. But Rains was remarkable.
Yeah, I wanted to mention Rains because he's someone who starred in many movies. He was a lead, much like George Sanders. And yet somehow there's something about him that still makes him a character actor.
Well, he was not a romantic lead. At least I think that's one way you might distinguish it. He was never a lover in the films. Somebody else who I think is more, a little more, but like Edward G. Robinson is very, very much a, you think of him as somebody would normally be a supporting actor, but he was a leading actor of great importance and great versatility, but he wasn't good looking and he wasn't like a, you know, the kind of leading man that one thinks of in Hollywood.
Right. Yeah, all those gangster guys. I mean, Bogey was attractive when he was young, but I don't know if he would necessarily, he's not Cary Grant.
No.
So,
but sometimes it goes the other way. You know, in the 70s, two actors who became important, really leading actors, were Lee Marvin and Charles Bronson.
That's true. Yeah.
And they had been nothing but character actors before that. They were considered too ugly to be leading men because they had kind of beat up faces, I guess, kind of mugs.
Yeah.
And they would play heavies or sort of comic dumb guys in movies. And then somehow they became action heroes.
Yeah. Yeah, the 70s was a weird time. And I kind of agree with Billy Wilder in that sense. Like, maybe Claude Rains the death of Claude Rains did signal that shift along with many other things. But just as far as our preference for good-looking leads versus interesting leads, like even someone like Dustin Hoffman. Is not necessarily conventionally good-looking or would not have been considered conventionally good-looking during the Hollywood studio era. And yet somehow he made that shift from character actor to – or he was never even considered a character actor. He was just always lead character.
Right. And even today, though, there's this sense of somebody can move from character actor to leading actor – but still be playing the same character. I don't know how, like Melissa McCarthy would be the
right, that. Right, yeah.
You got to, what is it, Spies? I like that movie a lot. But
I did
too. The whole thing is just built around her shtick, don't you think? I mean, anyway.
Maybe
it goes further than that. Maybe.
I think it plays with her persona very deftly. Yeah, that was one of my favorite movies of the year, actually.
Yeah, I really liked it a lot.
Yeah. But it's funny you mentioned Melissa McCarthy because I think that, generally speaking, men have made the transition more easily than women. Women throughout the ages, it seems, if you don't fit a certain profile, you will be a character actor, and that's if you're lucky.
Right.
But Melissa McCarthy seems to be the one exception.
Yeah, but you've also got examples today like Lena Dunham and what's her name, Trainwreck.
Amy Schumer.
Yeah. These are not conventionally beautiful people, but they seem to be building careers that have more leading actorish qualities to them.
Yeah. Well, here's hoping. I don't know. Yeah. We'll see if they can make the transition from TV to movies. Although TV is a great place for character actors.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you watch the Netflix original series BoJack Horseman by any chance?
No, I am way behind the curve with my Netflix stuff. So.
That's okay. They have this ongoing joke about Margot Martindale. They just everything. Mm-hmm. She's one of the voices. She plays herself. And she's always referred to as beloved character actress Margot Martindale. Yeah. So I think it's starting to become more of a thing people are aware of.
Right.
but it's funny how Margot Martindale is someone who has maybe made a transition from being a character actor into being more of a name, household name, solely because of being a character actor. It's this weird, I don't know, sort of flipped it on its head.
I do think the old classic Hollywood studio system, though, did have with its system a kind of way of building films around an ensemble of really good character actors. So that, for example, John Ford, he just had a stock company of amazing character actors. They just keep coming again and again in his films. I think Ward Bond, who worked for him for a lot, was also an actor who's probably in more good movies than anybody I can think of.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree.
But you get these films like Stagecoach, where you've got your handsome lead, John Wayne, surrounded in that stagecoach by character actors. They're all a lot of eccentric types. And the same thing would be like something like The Maltese Falcon. You know, Humphrey Bogart's in the middle, and around him is Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, Elijah Cook. It's just a stream of character actors. And Ward Bond is in that movie, too.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask you if you thought that there were any directors in particular that you thought employed character actors really well.
Yeah. Well, leaving The Maltese Falcon aside, I think that Warner's in that period had a kind of what you call a kind of stock company. Mm-hmm. And I think certain directors also had their own stock company. Ford had one. And for a brief time, Orson Welles did. Mm. He just brought the Mercury Theater ensemble over to Hollywood.
Right.
And so you had, Agnes Moorhead, Everett Sloan.
Yeah.
I mean, these are extraordinary actors and had great versatility.
Yeah.
But in Hollywood, they tended to be a little restricted in what they were, the way they were cast.
Yeah. Actually, Agnes Moorhead I wanted to mention her because she's one of my favorite actresses.
God, she burns a hole in the screen every time she appears.
Just steals every scene she's in. Uh-huh. And I guess there's certain my favorite character actors and actresses kind of fall into certain types. Uh-huh. So for women, I like that sort of stern, kind of harsh, angular features like Agnes Moorhead, Mercedes McCambridge, who also worked with Orson Welles in Touch of Evil. And then for like kind of brassy dames, kind of tell it like it is. So like Thelma Ritter.
Yeah, I was going to mention Thelma Ritter.
Yeah.
She always plays the same character, but boy, she makes every movie better when she's in it.
Absolutely. Yes. Every movie is better for having Thelma Ritter. And I really think that's why movies are no good now. You can't have Thelma Ritter in them anymore. It's terrible.
But how many times did she just play the housemaid from
it's
Brooklyn?
It's true.
Who makes wisecracks.
True.
But you're just nuts to see her in the movie.
I know, but it's always delightful. similar vein, Eve Arden.
Yeah, definitely.
Love her. Probably best known for Mildred Pierce playing Mildred's friend.
Yes.
But she popped up all over the place.
Yeah, I don't know if you probably know this, but Tony Curtis in Some Like It Hot, he imitates Cary Grant.
Mm-hmm.
But he says his female persona in that film was modeled on Eve Arden.
It's amazing. I guess it's also known as the principal in Grease, but that's not how I usually think of her. But,
she was very famous on the radio and TV in the 50s.
Yeah, great voice, just great speaking voice. Also, Jean Hagen, whenever she pops up, just love it. So let me ask you, what are some of your favorites?
I think in that period, Walter Brennan has to count.
Oh, yes.
And I think what's amazing about him is that he's one of those actors who got an opportunity to exhibit a certain kind of range, because he often played this kind of comic character that he plays with Bogart and Bacall and To Have and Have Not, you know, with the kind of gimpy legged fellow who's the alcoholic pal of Humphrey Bogart.
Right.
But then check out My Darling Clementine, where he mm-hmm. plays the villain. He's really scary in that.
Yeah. Movie. It's almost unrecognizable.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love Walter Brennan. That's, again, movies are worse off because he can't be in them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just, everything from, well, like Meet John Doe, and in that one, and like he just worked with all of the great classic mm-hmm. Hollywood directors, mm-hmm. Hawks and Capra and mm-hmm. Ford,
and some of these in the old classic era, some of these basically character actors were as popular and leading people in their films as the matinee idols.
Mm-hmm. So maybe the idea that that a character actor can't be a movie star is fallacy.
Yeah, that's wrong. No,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
Mickey Rooney was a huge, huge movie star.
Yeah. So basically, character actor is a euphemism for unattractive.
Well, I think that's it's not necessarily true, but I mean, I think that's how that was the logic of Hollywood. You wanted somebody with a weird face or some kind of eccentric thing to bring a certain color into the film.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like that's maybe a little too simplistic, though, because there is a certain something that someone like George Sanders brings to the screen.
Oh, yeah.
Sanders
was a very handsome man.
That's true.
He in fact, played a lot of leading roles.
That's true. He was the saint.
Yeah, the saint. These were B pictures, nevertheless. But, anyway.
But, there's something about him.
Yeah, he as you say, there's a certain George Sanders-ness.
Yes.
I think he's really superb in Portrait of Dorian Gray. In fact, he's the most effective incarnation of an Oscar Wilde character I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a match made in heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
George Sanders doing Oscar Wilde.
Yeah.
Writes itself.
Well, you could almost say that Addison DeWitt, the critic that he plays in All About Eve, is a little a wildish kind
absolutely
of guy.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
But you know, speaking of that, you know, Marilyn Monroe starts out as a character actor.
True,
she's in that film, and she's in The Asphalt Jungle, and I think when she becomes a movie star, she's still playing that same character, isn't she?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it speaks to the nature of what an actor is actually doing. Are you playing uh-huh. into a persona?
Yeah.
Or are you trying to create a character from scratch?
Yeah.
And I mean, you wrote a whole book on acting. So I tend to think that despite whatever Stanislavski method that an actor uses, you can never really escape the fact that you are a recognizable human being.
Sure.
With recognizable features and tics.
Of course.
The idea that anyone is anything but a character actor is kind of...
Exactly. No, the same rules apply to...
Yeah.
Cary Grant was playing Cary Grant.
Right.
You know? I mean, by that I don't mean he was playing himself.
Right.
He was playing a figure that he had developed as an actor. And I think, Marilyn was doing the same thing. I mean, and you could say that she was always typecast. You could say Marilyn Monroe always played a dumb blonde. And yes, she did most of the time, but... it's a very distinctive dumb blonde. You couldn't just put anybody in that role and they'd be as good. I mean, there's something that she does that's very individual.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So maybe we should do away with this term, character actor.
Well, no, I don't think we need to do away with it. But let's just say we don't know what it means exactly.
Yeah. we'll continue to think about it.
Yeah.
Before we sign off, I just want to give Jim a chance to tell us what he's been working on lately and what he plans to work on in the upcoming year. So, Jim, update our listeners and or give a sneak peek on upcoming projects for 2016.
Well, I think probably not a lot has changed for me since the last time I talked to you. All the Orson Welles events this year have kept me pretty busy. So I think since last talked to you, I was lecturing about Welles in Rio and in New York and in DeKalb, Illinois. And anyway, I've just been bopping around all over the place. And so that's kind of thrown me off my schedule. But I am still working on this book about Charles Burnett and looking forward to getting to a point where I can be working on it regularly every day because I'm behind schedule. But I think I'm currently writing about The Glass Shield, and I just wrote a little piece about Burnett and humor and comedy for a Spanish retrospective of Burnett's work, and that's what I'm doing.
Very cool. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Can we expect further updates on the book throughout the year?
yeah.
Maybe keep us updated.
Yeah. Okay.
And you'll let us know if anything else pops up. If there's anything we should be aware of, any Welles events.
Okay.
Coming up.
Well, I think they're about exhausted by now.
Ah, gotcha. The centennial has passed. 101 anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Well, if The Other Side of the Wind ever comes out, we shall see. Okay. Yeah. Well, all right. Well, we'll keep a lookout. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, who are some of your favorite character actors? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you'd like to join me on the George Sanders Appreciation Society, you should follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, be sure to rate us and leave us a comment on your preferred pod player, be it iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. Be sure to tell your friends at Apple and Google that we are not merely that podcast. We are a character podcast. Until we meet again, Jim, it was a pleasure to have you on the show again.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Enjoyed being there.
If listeners enjoyed this episode, they might also check out Jim's other appearances on the show, the Mulholland Drive episode and the Psycho episode. So I hope everyone goes and seeks those out. But until we meet again, take care.